ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Pro-Palestine and pro-Israel. A powerful voice lays out a truly democratic future for both peoples. Hello there, this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and across the Pacific on Radio Australia. Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian soon. As Australia begins its Royal Commission into anti-Semitism and social cohesion, there's important new research from the Pew Center. It shows we're one of the most religiously diverse countries in the world. Now, that might surprise people who expected much bigger countries, the US or India, to claim this diversity title. Yunping Tong is a senior researcher on the Pew team.
So in this study, we measure diversity based on how evenly each country's population is distributed among seven religious groups. And we find that as of 2020, Australia has a high level of religious diversity. And on the diversity scale, which ranges from 0 to 10, Australia receives a score of 7. That means the country has a relatively even mix of religious groups. And as of 2020, Australia ranks as the 9th place among all countries in the world.
Yeah, 9th out of more than 200 countries. That's very interesting. The major religious groups in Australia, how did you measure them? What were the scores?
As of 2020, there's no religious group makes up majority in the country. And the largest group is Christian. They made up 47%. And there are 42% of people who say they don't have a religion. And the rest of the population is largely spread across Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists. And this makes Australia has a more balanced distribution of religious groups than many countries in the world.
Yeah, what's the relevance, though, of Australia's place in the Asia-Pacific to these rankings? Because that's an important factor in the research, isn't it, Tong?
Yes. So among all the Asia-Pacific nations, Australia is the fourth most religiously diverse country, following Singapore, Taiwan, and South Korea. And New Zealand ranks the fifth in the Asia-Pacific region.
It's interesting the other countries in the region that are even more diverse. You mentioned Singapore. Singapore, we think of as a tiny city-state, really. How diverse is Singapore?
So on the diversity score, Singapore receives a score 9.3 out of 10, so it's highly diverse. And it's true, Singapore is a small country with less than 6 million people, but we find that there are multiple factors that contribute to Singapore's high level of diversity. And one is that the country's history as a trading post, which attract migrants from Malaysia, India, and China. And these countries all differ in their religious background. So they have large numbers of Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists. And in addition to that, the history, the country also has implemented policies to protect religious freedom and to maintain the country's ethnic diversity.
Now, what's going to surprise many people, Tong, is that the United States, which is a big immigrant country, I mean, one of the world's sort of original truly immigrant countries, well down on the list. What does the data show about religious diversity in the United States?
By our measure, which we look at the distribution of seven religious groups, U.S. ranks 32nd overall in religious diversity, and the country has a large Christian majority, which is 64%. And then there are 30% of people who say they don't have a religion, and the rest are spread across Muslims, Jews, Hindus, and Buddhists. But like we just mentioned, that Singapore has a small population. So immigration can impact the country's religious composition quite significantly, but US has such a large population. So if we only look at the countries with the largest population, the 10 countries with the largest population, US is actually the most diverse religiously.
Very interesting results about our nearest neighbor, which is Timor-Leste, but very similar to a faraway country, Moldova. What do these two countries have in common when it comes to religious diversity?
Right. These two countries, they are very interesting. So they are not very diverse. And in our countries, in our study, we actually classify them as having a low or very low level of diversity. And their populations are almost entirely Christian. For example, Timor-Leste, our estimates show this country is 99.5% Christian. These countries, it's interesting that they do have something in common, that we notice that these diverse countries, they're often surrounded by other countries with a similar religious background. For example, Moldova is located among heavily Christian countries. But at the same time, geographic location is just one of the many factors that shape a country's religious diversity. Other factors such as the country's history, the immigration policies, and the level of economic development also play a significant role.
What are the least religiously diverse countries on the entire list that Pew has compiled?
Among the total 201 countries and territories, we find Yemen is the least diverse country, followed by Afghanistan.
These countries, I suspect, are almost 100% Muslim.
Correct.
Yeah. Muslim majority nations seem to be the least religiously diverse. Do we know why?
We did notice that in all Muslim majority countries, Muslims often make up 90% or more of the country's population. But regarding why, so in this study, we focused on describing the diversity and we didn't really go beyond that. But that said, our global work we've done in the past does offer some insight. For example, we've observed that in countries where Muslims form a large majority, the religious composition has often been stable. And one main reason is that overall Muslims, they rarely switch religion, and virtually all people who were raised Muslim, they stay Muslim. Mm. By contrast, in many Christian majority countries, the Christian share has been declining due to people leaving the religion. And Australia is one example. Like back in 2010, Christians, they made up a clear majority, 67% of the country. But in 2020, the figure is 47%.
Yeah. Christianity is the most widely dispersed religion, it seems. Now, I guess there's a long history of colonization, which also spread Christianity. How does that show up in the data?
Yes, we have noticed that among all the seven groups we studied, Christians are the most geographically spread out. And there are many millions of Christians in all six regions of the world, except for the Middle East and North Africa. And there are only 12 million Christians. They are often the majority group of countries in the world. In fact, in 120 countries around the world, Christians are the majority group. So it's not very surprising that among the top 10 most diverse countries, Christians are often also the largest religious group.
Very good to speak with you, Tong. Thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you for having me.
Yunping Tong from the Pew Research Center in Washington. When and why does criticism of Israel often descend into anti-Semitism? How do you build a free Palestine and a secure, truly democratic Israel? Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland has spent 25 years making the case for Jewish-Palestinian partnership. He's also the author of a new book about resistors in Nazi Germany. It's called The Traitor's Circle. Jonathan's in Melbourne and Sydney next week with the Jewish Independent and the New Israel Fund Australia.
Good to be with you, Andrew.
Now, you've come to a country that is about to embark on a royal commission into anti-Semitism and social cohesion. Jonathan, you are an acclaimed journalist and author. You know about the critical importance of free expression, of always questioning power, raising your voice against injustice. And I've been reading your columns for nigh on a quarter of a century. How does a society remain
rigorous in its debate and disagreement and preserve social cohesion at the same time?
Well, it's not easy. I think that's the first thing to say. It's, you know, there are people who believe these things can just be neatly separated. And I think just reality and the lived experience that we've all gone through these last two or three years shows you these things are difficult to manage. I think, though, you can and should and have to be vigilant about where free speech and free expression does shade into, draw upon, echo tropes, motifs of anti-Jewish hatred that go back centuries. And it is perfectly possible to have a very intense, forthright debate about, for example, Israel and the Middle East, which I suspect is partly, you know, implied in your question, without drawing on themes of, for example, global Jewish conspiracy or dual loyalties or demonic style evil. And it's surprising to me still to see how difficult that is for some people who, you know, cannot get through a paragraph or a march or a protest about Israel without resorting and reverting to that kind of imagery and language.
Yeah.
It should be possible to do one without the other. So have the forthright debate. Be as trenchant as you like in your criticisms or observations about today's Middle East. But it helps if you've got a voice over your shoulder or in one ear, just thinking, hold on a minute, does that phrase, does that idea, does that particular focus have an unhappy and dark history? And quite often it does.
Yeah, speaking of a dark history, you wrote a column recently which I thought had a great impact. You did ask whether Australia, which had been to some extent, and the phrase was the golden Medina for world Jewry, was in fact that today. Looking from afar, because this I think helps, what is the impression abroad about Australia as a haven, as a home for Jewish people?
Yeah, thank you for observing that piece. So, yeah, in there I argued that Jews for millennia had been, in a way, a people of fantasy. They had carried with them a fantasy that whatever their current travails and problems, there was somewhere else where life might be better. For the most obvious incarnation of that fantasy is the fantasy of Zion itself, that Jews for two millennia in exile, wandering the world, would pray three times a day. They would turn towards Jerusalem and pray three times a day for a return to Zion. The contemporary modern day Zionist movement, founded in the 19th century, was only actually drawing on 2,000 years of religious tradition. And it was the idea that, you know, an Eastern European Jew who was, you know, suffering poverty and pogrom could think that one day we will be back in Jerusalem and in Zion. That was one fantasy. Then there was this other fantasy, which also actually the late 19th century and into the 20th century gained ground, which was of the United States as the new golden Medina, as you quoted, the golden land where, you know, the streets of New York would be paved with gold and there was opportunity, etc. And I mentioned how, you know, sentimentally, the final scenes of Fiddler on the Roof, that archetypal Jewish folktale, really, had the Jewish characters as they are exiled and pogromed from their village of Anatevka. One character is going to New York, another is going to Israel, to Palestine, to Jerusalem, as then was. What I had also realized was that much more quietly than those other two, a fantasy developed, I would say, in the post-1945 period, of a place, a third place, at the opposite end of the world, as it were, where the sun always shone, the skies were blue, and you were away from the demons of Europe. And that place was Australia.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of Holocaust survivors, as you obviously know, made their homes in Australia, driven by the idea of Europe doesn't want us. Let's go to the opposite end of the world from Europe. The Middle East is too complicated and too difficult because there is another people already there in the historic biblical land of Israel, namely the Palestinians. But Australia is out of harm's way.
Yeah, and a disproportionate number of Holocaust survivors have settled in Australia and made just enormous contributions. I wonder, though, Johnny, what happened after the Bondi Massacre? How did the international Jewish diaspora start to see Australia?
So that's the point, is that fantasy that in a way had been sort of below radar in parallel with the Zionist dream of Israel and the dream of the United States. The third one was Australia. That dream, I would say, was shattered on Bondi Beach in December of 2025. And I put it as starkly as that, that just in a moment, the Jews of Britain, but also of the United States and elsewhere, suddenly thought, those nightmares that Jews have tried to escape, those nightmares about which they have imagined a place that is free of such horrors, actually, they follow us everywhere, even to the ends of the earth.
Mm. Jonathan, you are what I would call a critical, sometimes searingly critical, friend of Israel. How do you criticize Israel without delegitimizing it as a nation?
It's a good and important question. Part of it is motive, because you said there, rightly actually, to describe me as a critical friend. What does that mean? Friend in the sense that I want to see what is the world's largest Jewish community, namely Israel, not just survive, but thrive. I don't want it just to exist, but to flourish, because it is the only Jewish country in the world, and it is the largest Jewish community in the world. So if you are somebody who wants to see the Jewish people thrive and flourish, you cannot wish ill on the largest single body of Jewish people anywhere in the world. So that means I'm a friend, and that means I grieve its tragedies and I celebrate its triumphs. All of that said, and to me, there's no contradiction, I am fiercely critical when I believe Israel is on a path that is mistaken, not just in terms of the impact it has on another people, namely the Palestinians, but even for its own interests, its own self-interest. I believe Israel has been on that path for decades, without giving away perhaps my age, but I am born in 1967. I am as old as the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. That was always billed to the world as temporary, yet on it goes, denying the Palestinians the place that they have to have and should have as a state of their own. I simultaneously want that to happen, and I want it to happen alongside a flourishing and safe Israel.
I mean, I should also say, I would say that you're a friend of the Palestinians as well. This really hit me, Jonathan, this comment that you made recently. You said that Israel has gone from being, even if this was never really the case, but it went from the aspiration of being the light among nations to the leper among nations. What do you mean?
Yeah, I was referring there to the transformation in terms of how the world is seen, where there was a period, and a lot of progressive people now would be astonished to realize this, but that left-wingers and progressives around the world in the late 40s, early 50s saw the creation of this new Jewish republic as a progressive cause, even actually an anti-colonial cause, you know, that the Jews of Palestine exiled for 2,000 years kicked out the British, the imperial ruler, and formed their own new republic. And that was seen as a progressive cause. And for a while, it was seen, I mean, now it looks very naive, but, you know, it had a woman prime minister before most countries did that. There was a tremendous kind of equality between the sexes, women in uniform in the Israeli army and so on. The kibbutz, this kind of socialist paradise, that was part of the image. And I, you know, Israel had huge underlying problems from the start. But in terms of the image that was seen around the world, there was something of that. And, you know, some of its writers and artists, you know, an Israeli author won the Nobel Prize for Literature very early on in the country's history. It was seen as somehow a country that was bringing light. Now, in the post-October 7 period, and because of the war in Gaza, or coinciding with the war in Gaza, Israel is either on its way to, or has, I think, pretty well arrived at pariah status. So it is under investigation from the International Court of Justice for the gravest possible crime, namely genocide. It is under boycott in many places in the world, and it is seen as being outside, beyond the pale of the family of nations. And that is quite a transformation. Now, plenty of my fellow Jews are outraged by that, because they say, look, however bad Israel is behaving, the response from the world, this singling out, is disproportionate, or it's somehow oddly exceptional. And the example, that the most current one I hear a lot, is look at Iran, which, according to a lot of credible reports, killed in the space of 2 days, January the 8th and January the 9th, according to CBS News and others, 30,000 people. 30,000 people in 2 days. I do put it before you that the degree of pariahdom attached to Israel does at least invite some questions about why that animates passions that are dormant in other cases.
Yeah. I mean, by the same token, you've also written recently that you can condemn Hamas and its actions as evil, even as you support the Palestinians in their quest for a life free of occupation and oppression. Why is it hard, though, for some people to condemn Hamas and yet support Palestine?
I'm really glad you raised that, Andrew. And I'm also glad that you described me earlier as being a friend of the Palestinians as well, because that's exactly how I see it. To me, it's one of these classic examples that happens so often in politics where the answer is both. And so often people think it's either or. Either you're pro-Palestinian or you're pro-Israel. Either you're pro-Palestinian or you're anti-Hamas. To me, there is no contradiction. If anything, if you are truly pro-Palestinian, you've got to be anti-Hamas because Hamas are oppressing Palestinians. Look at what happened in the immediate aftermath of the ceasefire brokered, credited to Donald Trump in October, as Israel pulls back, not completely, not enough, pulled back from just under half of the territory of Gaza. Hamas emerged from their tunnels, from their protective spaces where they'd been protecting themselves even while their people were under bombardment, and reassert control, and they start hanging people, and they start executing people who were dissenters. If you are a believer in freedom, and political freedom, you cannot possibly support Hamas. And if you believe in Palestinian self-determination and Palestinian freedom, yes, Israel is denying that in the West Bank or choking that off, limiting it, suffocating it. But so is Hamas in Gaza. You cannot be free as a Palestinian in Gaza because you are under the chokehold. You're in the chokehold of a theocratic, oppressive regime who allow no freedom of speech or dissent or anything of the sort. So, the Palestinians need to be free of Israeli domination. They also need to be free of Hamas.
And here on the Religion and Ethics Report on ABC Radio National with Andrew West, I'm speaking with Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian. I want to talk to you, Jonathan, about your latest non-fiction book. It's called The Traitor's Circle, The Rebels Against the Nazis and the Spy Who Betrayed Them. This book, yes, it is written like a political thriller, but there's a deeply moral message behind this. Firstly, Jonathan, who were the traitors in the circle?
It's a true story, wholly true story about a group of high-born elite Germans in 1940s Berlin, drawn from either the aristocracy or the upper reaches of Berlin high society, including people who had served in government in the pre-Hitler period. What they all have in common, these people, is they are anti-Nazi and anti-Hitler. They are engaged in their own forms of defiance, of resistance. Some are hiding Jews. Some are smuggling key bits of information out. Some are even involved at the edges of plots to kill Adolf Hitler. They gather for a tea party in secret on the 10th of September 1943. This actually happened. What they did not know is that sitting around the table with them was someone they thought was one of their own, they thought was a kindred spirit, but who instead was about to betray all the rest to the Gestapo. And that's a real event. And I tell the story a bit like a whodunit. So you and I are not now going to reveal
who no,
the player was. But the reader will, I hope, be reading it through and think, well, is it the countess? In fact, there were two countesses in this group. Is it one of the two countesses? Is it the ambassador's widow? Is it the former diplomat? Is it the doctor? Is it the headmistress? Is it the former model? Who is it sitting around that table that betrayed the rest with deadly consequences? Yeah. This was a story that would end in the execution chamber with the hangman's rope and with the guillotine. But really at the heart of it is the extraordinary heroism, courage of this group of people who crucially, and this is the crucial point, Andrew, is because I'm glad the way you describe it as a sort of moral story. They had nothing to gain. That's the one thing they all have in common. They have nothing to gain from defying or resisting the regime, the Third Reich. If anything, they had a huge amount to lose. These were people who, because they weren't Jewish, because in many cases they were aristocrats, nobody was going to come knocking on their door. The Gestapo weren't interested in them. If they had kept their heads down, they would have been fine.
What struck me here is that there wasn't a lot of resistance in Germany, but there seemed to be circles of resistance. I'd read in the past about groups of intellectuals and middle class or you know, any German who just thought, I hate the regime, I can't do anything about it, I'm going into what they called internal exile. They checked out of civic life. This was a group of people, though, and we should put some examples to it. One of the countesses swam across a lake to accompany people that she was helping to escape into Switzerland, I think. You've used the term the traitor's circle sort of ironically, because they saw themselves, didn't they, as patriots. Their country had been stolen from them.
100%. So, firstly, you're completely right that some of the acts of daring these people commit were just astonishing. So there's this woman, one of the two countesses, she swims people across, she escorts them across Lake Constance, you know, Germany on one side, Nazi Germany, on the other, Switzerland, and therefore freedom. And she swims for 2 hours in the pitch black. They were known as the Black Swimmers. They did this at night. She also leads people through the sewers of Berlin. She harbors Jews who are in hiding. They were known as submarines, these hidden Jews. Submarines because they had to be quiet, they had to be hidden, and they had to be beneath the surface. So there's people involved in amazing physical heroism, which is itself astonishing. And they did it for no conceivable benefit. But they were, of course, branded as traitors by the regime. And that's the sense in which one of the meanings of the title. They, of course, were anything but traitors. They were deep patriots. They were doing this out of love of country. One of the people involved did say she was doing this so that people around the world would know that there was another Germany, one that predated Hitler's Germany and that would outlive Hitler's Germany. They also thought, by the way, that they were loyal, not just to this older notion of Germany, but to a higher authority. And this is, I think, you know, where religion and ethics comes into it. Several of the people in this group were committed Christians, and they believed that they would be held accountable to a higher authority than Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. They would ultimately be answerable to God and, in their view, to Jesus Christ. And that's why they felt they had to do the right thing, because their ultimate allegiance was to an authority that was beyond and higher than the Nazi state. And I think this book serves as a useful shaft of light, I hope, into how people in a different era coped with them. And there are, I think, some lessons that do resonate today.
We can add this book as a shaft of light to 25 years worth of columns and commentary. Jonathan Friedland, he's a Guardian columnist. Jonathan's also the host of the Guardian's America podcast. His new book is called The Traitor's Circle, The Rebels Against the Nazis and the Spy Who Betrayed Them. Jonathan's coming to Australia as part of a tour sponsored by the New Israel Fund and the Jewish Independent website. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
It's been a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this episode. You can follow us at ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to producer Mandy Roberts and Harvey O'Sullivan. I'm Andrew West. Join us again for the Religion and Ethics Report.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.